On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Market volatility is the nice way of putting it. By the end of last week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average had lost 800 points in the big summer sell-off of 2007, and the ride isn't over. After years of lining the pockets of the hedge fund rich with the IOUs of the subprime mortgage poor, the low interest blowout is over. A credit crunch is on. Mortgages are more expensive. So is the money that drove the private equity whirl. And holding the bag at the end of the party, maybe you. Up next on Point, Wall Street's big wobble and where we go now. Joining me first today from Washington is Greg Ipp, economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Greg, good to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
Greg, we've talked for a long time, but never since you went to work for Rupert Murdoch or since he bought your company. Have you seen him padding around the offices in his stocking feet at The Wall Street Journal yet?
Well, the deal hasn't even closed yet, so it's a bit early for that. But, the new ownership I don't think will change much for me or my colleagues. We're going to continue to do the best we can, just reporting the stories as we see them.
We're trusting you to tell it like it is. What is going on here, Greg?
Well, Tom, obviously the thing that people have noticed most is the fact that we had a very rough week in the stock market. But let's look back a bit, because this is one of those times when the problems in the stock market actually started in the bond market, mm-hmm. and specifically the bonds issued by companies and risky companies and borrowers, such as those who take out subprime mortgages. And what happened is that in the prior years, it had been very easy for those people to borrow at low rates. And sometime this year, people noticed that some of these people were defaulting at very high rates, and suddenly what became a concern kind of snowballed into a panic, and now it's been very difficult for those people to borrow. The rates that they're being charged is very high, and the stock market has started to notice. They're worried that some of the, for example, companies that were on the verge of being bought up through what we call a leveraged buyout no longer will be, so their stocks mm-hmm. are falling. Financial companies who had made so much money basically intermediating this boom, their profits will fall, so their stocks are hurting. And at a larger level, there's a concern that these problems in the credit markets will hurt the overall economy, and that's also another reason the stock market is down.
So this whole big shake and bake goes back to little houses in Oklahoma and L.A. and Washington, D.C. that people could barely afford but got anyway and have trouble making the payments on?
Yeah, Tom. In fact, you could actually go back somewhat further. It starts in a number of big trends. For example, the fact that the Fed kept interest rates quite low from 2001 through 2003 to get the economy out of its recession and to avoid deflation. And also the fact that since the Asian crisis of almost 10 years ago this month, Asian countries have been saving a lot of money and sending those savings over here, and that's helped keep our interest rates low. So really, all of this started with the very low cost of borrowing, which I think incentivized a lot of people to take on leverage and indulge in some risky schemes.
We're trying to get a handle on how big a wobble this is. I mean, on the one hand, there have been some fairly decent indicators from the economy nationally and globally recently. On the other hand, we've got people on Wall Street making what sound like incredibly jittery noises. So, help us out. We're the little guys in the cheap seats. Are we on the brink of disaster here, or is this manageable, or nobody knows?
Well, first of all, it looks like a healthy correction now, but let's keep in mind that bear markets always begin as a healthy correction. Mm. That said, I think some perspective is necessary. Mm-hmm. Even now, after a very bad week last week, the Dow is only down 6% from its record high. That's really not that much. I mean, it needs to be 10% to be a correction, and we haven't had something like that in this five-year bull market. And it only seems volatile because the prior years were so calm. In fact, there was something unnatural about that. So in some sense, I think people might be getting a little overly concerned now just because they haven't seen this volatility in some years. But in fact, it's really not that unusual.
Then, then explain, though, Greg, why it's the pros who seem to be the most nervous right now. I mean, you know, it's not exactly every weekend picnic conversation, but the stuff that people in your world are saying in the newspapers today is sort of unnerving.
Well, Tom, I've been covering financial markets and the economy for 10 years now, and I've seen this every time there's a sell-off in the markets or a bout of a risk aversion or something like that. It's the folks who are closest to the markets who take it the hardest. I mean, those are people who are often losing a lot of money that very day because they're watching essentially what was padding their big bonuses in prior years melt away. Now, I don't want to downplay the significance because, again, big problems start with small problems. So the fact that it's only the pros who are worried right now doesn't mean that eventually Main Street will worry. But let's take a look now, shall we, at the Main Street situation.
Yes, please.
We're now in about the sixth year of a pretty good economic expansion. And it's not unusual to have a little bit of a slowing at that point, especially since the Federal Reserve did raise interest rates for about 2 years in order to prevent an inflationary head of steam from developing. Mm-hmm. And indeed, the economy has grown at a slower pace for the last year. In the last few months, we've seen a few signs of further slowing. The housing market continues to look for a bottom. The unemployment rate ticked up by a tiny amount in June, July.
Right.
And consumer spending seems to have slowed.
Okay.
None of those things yet are in recession territory by any means, and they could be quite consistent with the slowdown people are looking for.
Mm-hmm.
I think, Tom, the thing that we have to be on the lookout for is the possibility that the troubles in the financial markets stop being simply a financial market issue and become more of a problem for the broad economy.
How would that happen? How do they bleed over? How does it turn from, you know, bankers with sleepless nights to Main Street with sleepless nights?
Tom, I think it happens in one of two ways. The first is whether the aversion to credit that the aversion to taking on risk that's
right.
now in Wall Street spreads from affecting just the very riskiest lenders, the people who frankly probably shouldn't have been getting credit in the first place, to creditworthy borrowers. So if we see, for example, people with good, you know, credit ratings unable to get conventional mortgages, that would definitely be a problem. Then you're really sapping demand from the housing market.
And mortgage rates are already up substantially even for well-qualified borrowers, right?
Yes, they are up, but I'm not sure that I would say substantially, Tom. Again, they seem to be up a lot, but that's relative to the very low rates of prior years. But there are some troubling signs. In the last few days, we've had some big banks and borrowers saying they're not going to do mortgages any longer for people who can't fully document their income, and they're not going to do no down payment loans.
Mm-hmm.
So there are those warning signs. Now, the second way we might worry is if the decline in the stock market becomes large enough that people feel like they've lost a lot of their wealth and therefore they stop spending. And that could also affect corporations who are unable to borrow or to issue new shares, and that might impair business investment. But again, we haven't seen that yet to a large extent, but the situation is very fluid. It changes day to day.
And what about for the hedge fund crowd, the people and the private equity people who have made so much money doing all these big corporate buyouts with the easy credit? Is the party over for them? Are we going to see more of them imploding? We've seen some already.
Well, it certainly seems that given how much froth there was and how much money those people made and how many new funds started up in the last few years, that yes, that there probably is more air to come out of that particular boom. But when you sort of think about what will we look like when the dust settles, it's probably the case that we'll probably still have a pretty substantial hedge fund and private equity industry because these people are, after all, in some extent, exploiting innovations in the financial markets, which are longer lasting than just the last few years.
In the cheap seats, we watch and wonder and hold our breaths. Greg Ipp at The Wall Street Journal, thanks as always for joining us. Great to have you with us.
Always a pleasure.
We're looking at the markets and the credit crunch that's underway right now on Wall Street with implications right across the country and around the world. You can join the conversation at 800-423-8255. We've got a couple of terrific economists with us today and market watchers to help us sort out what's going on here. Lots on the line in 401k bundles sitting in the stock market and in equity sitting in houses and in hopes and dreams for people young and old. Joining us today from New Haven, Connecticut is Robert Shiller, economics professor at Yale University and author of Irrational Exuberance. He's co-founder of Macro Markets, an investment bank that trades in real estate. He's well-known, renowned maybe, for his timely predictions about the bursting of the 1990s tech stock bubble. Robert Shiller, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Great to have you with us. And joining us here in the studio is Alan Sinai, a leading analyst of markets worldwide, former chief global economist for Lehman Brothers. He's now president and chief global strategist for Decision Economics, Inc., a financial advisory firm. Alan Sinai, thank you very much for being here.
Nice to be here, Tom.
Robert Shiller, first to you. You called it last time. What about this time? You know, is this the sound of a bubble going again or something else?
Well, it's very interesting. This is not early 2000 again, and it's not 1929.
Good.
In the stock market, we are seeing volatility and skewness. We're seeing a tendency for sharp drops. But I think the most important thing that's happening in the big picture, and this should be stressed, is that we have recently gone through, and we may be still going through, the biggest housing boom in history. And home prices have gotten very high. And that is a thing that's been going on for years, you might say almost a decade. And it shows signs of slowing down, and we are in an uncertain situation now. That is the big story. And that's what's driving a lot of what's happening in the stock market.
At the bottom of everything, coming back to people's homes and houses and the dreams and what they've invested in those, Alan Sinai, does that thread unravel the whole cloth? I mean, people seem pretty upset, Alan.
No, there's unfortunately another thread out there. That particular thread is exactly the view I have. We've never had the kind of housing boom we had and had it so levered on one asset, residential real estate, mm-hmm. in a myriad of ways. And that is unraveling now. Anything tied to U.S. residential real estate, directly or indirectly, any institution with exposure there, any paper, stock market paper or debt paper, CDOs, CDXs.
How much of the economy is that tied?
Not enough, but we have a red flag on that, and that's about as serious as it can get. It's a bad place to be exposed, and that's true for all of us who own homes. Now, the second thread that's more worrisome is broader than that. Credit, it's liquidity, and the way in which we finance this expansion. Never before have we had so many non-bank financial intermediaries putting up money in one form or another. I wouldn't say money, it's funding through balance sheet expansion. I'm talking about the venture capital firms, the private equity funds, the investment banking brokerage houses, the banks who set up subsidiaries who do this kind of thing.
Steve's on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air, my friend.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm calling to ask what you all think Bernanke will do with interest rates coming up. The dollar has, you know, tanked 40% in the past few years, and if he lowers the rate now, that's really going to drive the dollar down even further, which will be a disaster. I mean, you know, all of our incomes are valued in dollars.
Right.
And if he raises rates, Greenspan a few years ago told people to everybody should take out adjustable rate mortgages, and then he raised the rates 17 times.
Surprise!
So, contrary to what the person from the Wall Street Journal said, the Bank of America just raised their 30-year jumbo rates from 6% and change to 8%. That was last week.
That sounds like a lot to me. If you're in the housing market, that hurts.
So this is a major disaster, even if he does nothing for the housing market. And with inflation going, with real inflation, not the imaginary CPI numbers, but real inflation, what it costs to live, as bad as it is, it seems like rates are going up, and that's just going to kill an already hurting housing market.
Steve, we can hear you're watching very closely and laying it out stark there. The Federal Reserve, of course, meeting tomorrow. Short-term rates now at 5.2%, and Ben Bernanke and the gang have to look at what to do about that. Robert Shiller, put yourself in their shoes for a moment. What's the big picture they're looking at when it comes to interest rates and, you know, the dollar's falling? Steve's right. Of course, a lot of our debt's been carried by foreigners, China and the rest. So what are Bernanke's options and parameters here?
Well, the Fed has left interest rates fixed for about a year, and there is nothing that I see in this month's data that would suggest that they'll change that. The core PCE, which is a measure of inflation, has been going down. The rate of increase has been going down, so inflation looks under control. We saw some signs of weakness in the first quarter GDP numbers, but now that's not confirmed with later data. So it just seems like from the standpoint of what to do at this FOMC meeting, nothing is happening. I think the problems that we have are problems that will maybe unfold over coming months. I think the Fed will have a wait-and-see attitude right now.
So, and take us to what Alan Sinai was talking about as well. Non-bank financial intermediaries are playing such a big role out there now.
Right.
These are guys who run and gun pretty fast, the hedge fund and private equity. They've made a lot of money doing it. They've spread risk all over the place, but to the point where it's sort of hard to read where it is and where it may land. Do you see that as a point of concern?
That is one of the major concerns, actually, that people are talking about. And so it represents confidence problems with the market. The slogan or the key word now is the world is awash with liquidity. And part of the
that was the key word two weeks ago, many times. Yeah.
And that's not really a reference to what the world's central banks are doing. It's a reference to the way financial intermediaries are working. And it's true that, as Alan was saying, when asset prices go up, balance sheets improve, and then these financial intermediaries start buying more aggressively, and it's a sort of feedback. Professor Shin at Princeton has written a paper about this. It looks like there is a feedback mechanism that generates liquidity. It's sort of a bubble phenomenon, and so it may unravel if confidence erodes. But nothing has happened yet. Nothing is dramatically happening at the moment.
Alan Sinai, take us to two points then. First, to Steve's question about what the Fed is looking at and Ben Bernanke as they meet tomorrow, what their options are, where they're constrained by our trade deficit, our big borrowing over all these years, the price of the dollar and all the rest. And then I want to come back to what it means that the banks no longer sort of control how money's lent and where it goes. But first, to Bernanke's challenge here.
Well, the Fed is focused on inflation risk as a predominant concern and on the economy. And the economic data are quite good. There's nothing wrong with the economic data. And, in fact, even the employment report, which was a little bit soft, was really quite okay. And core inflation is that's the one they watch. And the caller's right. It's kind of a ridiculous thing we all pay those prices. The Fed watches that. But that's under control. So there's nothing there to make them do anything other than keep the rate the same. But what's going on in the markets, I think they have to say something about that, along the lines of Jean-Claude Trichet, of the head of the European Central Bank, the other day, who said we're watching it. Because what I have called in my work the financial factor in the business cycle, which we're seeing a big taste of that, and that's the role of the intermediaries. In the old days, it was banks and it was credit. Even before that, it was money and it was a money crunch. Now it's something even bigger. That financial factor often is something you see at the top of a business cycle. It's decisive, and we're seeing the taste of the potential harm to the economy in the future. You wouldn't see it in the numbers now, but it's 3, 6, 9 months down the road, and that is really my concern.
It's
too soon
factor,
for the Fed to do something about that.
Right, so they're likely to sit tight. But when you say financial factor, you're talking about the way that money gets kind of corralled and lent and packaged and risk it gets shared through all these new instruments that have been developed since banks sort of moved out of the center court.
Yeah, it's not money. It's not credit. It's even bigger. It's all wrapped up around balance sheets and very interesting instruments that spread risk.
But for example,
when there's stress
market,
on the system, it goes the other way. The fear I have is if real estate prices in the U.S. are going down, which they are, and they're going to continue to go down, and the stock market prices go down, and maybe another asset class or two prices go down, and you can't do the deals.
Right.
Because the financing isn't there,
and
we don't have a crunch yet because there's still money flowing, funds flowing. But the private equity funds take private a company, and then at the end of 3 or 4 years, they don't see the returns. They won't be able to sell it the way they did before. You actually have the upturn operating in reverse, and it can be a factor that will accelerate the downturn and give us a recession.
Robert Shiller, we've talked a lot in recent months about that giddy ride at the top, sort of billionaires in hedge funds and private equity funds doing all kinds of very, very lucrative deals, and the danger of that unwinding if it went the other way and crashing down on everybody else. Do we see that risk now?
Well, we've seen a lot of financial innovation, and overall, financial innovation is a wonderful thing because finance is a technology that drives the economy. On the other hand, when we see financial innovation, it often brings unfamiliar new tools, and so there can be accidents. When they invented steam engines, there were boiler explosions, and people got hurt. So when we invent CDOs, we don't know, for example, the collateralized debt obligations, which hold mortgage assets. We don't know what they mean and how they'll function.
This is where mortgages get sliced and diced, and people buy little portions and own it all over the world instead of one bank holding a pile of mortgages straight up.
And that's good. It's good to slice and dice risk and put it in the right places. But in the meantime, we have to learn how to use these things. And one of the problems in the current environment is that the rating agencies for the CDOs and other complex obligations have been, I think, too generous in their ratings. And it's given a sense of complacency about instruments that are really risky.
So AAA ratings for stuff that when you pull back the covers may be ugly.
Right. And the fundamental problem is that they're new. and we have to learn about them, and we're in a process of learning. There might be some pain in that process.
Alan Sinai, where is that pain going to land? I mean, what we've been watching so far...
It's going to land on all of us.
Well, that's it, but the guys and gals who have worked out these new instruments, we've read for years now about the, you know, billion-dollar payouts.
You know, in tough circumstances, they will lose their jobs, too.
Well, it hardly matters if you've made your billions, but if it falls down on everybody who's trying to save in their little 401k for maybe someday a retirement, it doesn't seem quite fair.
Well, we don't want to be too extreme about this, and so far we've lost a lot of the certain chunk of what was added to asset prices and balance sheets and the value of stocks and the 401ks. We had a tremendous run, so
That's true. We
haven't really gone down a lot. Mm-hmm. And we have to remember that we do get recessions. You know, six, seven, 8 years, we do get recessions. I think that's probably ultimately is what's going to happen, and we'll have to live with it for a while. There'll be a lot of losses of jobs. And the way it happens is the financial institutions will cut back people. We saw plus 27,000 in the non-farm payroll report on Friday. I can't believe, given the stress that the investment banking brokerage firms are under, the risks, the hedge funds, that they won't start cutting people. And that will be the leading edge of our way of working toward at the least a recession-like environment. And the stock market will at least correct and probably ultimately will have a bear equity market as a result. And we're going to have to live with this and these risks for a year or two like we always do,
right,
and kind of restructure how we do our investments and trading. And look—
So investment bankers selling pencils or maybe just sitting by the pool instead of working.
I doubt it. I doubt it. But nobody likes to lose a job no matter who you are.
No, that's true.
And
yep.
It's always a big shock. Look, I've seen this process before. Mm-hmm. The uniform is always different, but underneath the uniform, it's the same player.
Same player, but underneath it all, I mean, especially these days, a lot of individuals trying to figure out if this means calamity for what little nest egg they put together.
Well, I mean, think calamity would be overstating it. I think investors mm-hmm. need to be cautious and hold back, not rush to buy anything like real estate or stocks.
But if
and
you're
just stay safe in terms of protecting principal, tactically safe until they see how this goes.
Does that mean pull money out of the stock market or sit tight?
It all depends on the individual portfolio. I think it's nothing ever wrong, even though profits are today less in holdings than they were a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
You never go wrong taking some profits and then sitting there with cash on the sidelines for a while when you're going through an episode like this. At best, we have a stock market correction. At best, it would be mm-hmm. what we've had now, and it's over. I don't think
right.
it's over.
And that could happen. It's happened that way a couple of times.
I don't think it's over because we haven't seen the economic impact of what we're seeing in the financial markets already today. And so suppose we have a standard 10% stock market correction.
Yep.
That would be 12,500, 600 on the Dow Jones. That would be 1,400, 1,425 in the S&P 500. And we get over it and we start climbing back up because underneath the U.S. and global economies are resilient and they stay okay. That's a very possible scenario. But I think while we wait to see if that happens,
mm-hmm.
we being ordinary investors,
yep.
they should just kind of watch and keep their powder dry and be careful, make sure they're protected on the principle that they haven't overleveraged themselves in any investments.
Robert Shiller, does it then finally come back to the little guy as to whether this spirals into something worse and bigger, to that sort of broader confidence of investors and consumers?
Well, confidence is of investors and consumers is a big interest of mine because I think that is what primarily drives the market. And so I've been doing questionnaire surveys of home buyers
mm-hmm.
and also of high-income investors about mm. their stock investments. And it seems that confidence is okay at this point. In our recent home buyer survey,
mm-hmm.
we found that most home buyers are pessimistic about the short run, but they are still optimistic about the long run. In our survey in Los Angeles, we found that the average expectation was that there would be a decline of just under 1% in home prices in L.A. next year, but they expect almost 10% per year increase over the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So Greg Ipp said at the beginning that the housing market is, quote, looking for a bottom. That's the way it's viewed. The general public is still optimistic about housing, and they're still optimistic about the stock market. That means that we're not immediately likely to see any huge correction. I think there could be a correction, but it would be not record-breaking this point.
I have to say, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Rochester, Minnesota, and Larry. Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
Do you think it's possible that some of the banks might actually begin to show a lot of distress eventually? And I've heard rumors of something called like a plunge protection team, where if the stock market is really hurting, that the federal government will come in and actually buy shares in order to save it, or just create money to give to the banks and brokerages to keep them afloat.
Okay, let's deal with both of those. Alan Sinai first. There's the
We're nowhere near that situation yet.
But I mean, is such a thing even ever possible with the scale of markets?
Yeah, it would be, but the stock market would have to be down 25 or 30%. We'd have to be in a recession situation before you'd see anything like that. Those are pretty desperate moves. But the question, though, about banks and non-bank financial intermediaries, they are at some considerable risk, as diversified as they are globally.
Right.
And how they have restructured their businesses to protect themselves and laid off a lot of risk on investors rather than absorbed and held the risk, say, on mortgages themselves. Their fortunes can turn on a dime. Look, for example, at Bear Stearns.
Two of its hedge funds collapsed in June. We just saw over the weekend the story about one of the co-presidents there, Warren Spector, out on his ear now. I was fascinated by that. The CEO who brought him in and fired him and Spector, both bridge champions, national bridge sort of super-rated champions, played in Nashville at the North American Bridge Championship in late July. The next thing you know, the market's on a tumble.
Right. Warren actually won. Warren, that I saw him on Martha's Vineyard at a social event not too long ago.
So he's good, but not good enough to see what was coming
here. Well, those things happen. Warren's a very capable man. And, Bear Stearns, if it has further problems, then the head of Bear Stearns will be under some pressure himself to resign because we'll see what happens there. But I think from an investor's point of view, we would say definitely be underweight the investment banking brokerage and the banking space, if not out of those stocks, as a precautionary measure at this time. Because when you go through a financial stress situation and other business cycles, those stocks have just not done well. And you see it happening.
It's already down 15% as of Friday, financial stocks.
Yep.
Let's go to Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And Michael. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I really enjoy your show, by the way.
Thank you, sir.
So my question, I have a couple of questions here, but as I listen to this, the more I hear about this, as I've heard over the last probably several weeks, it makes me very, very nervous about everything relative to finances. I am one of those little people that intends to rely on my 401k for retirement 20, 30 years from now.
You and just about everybody else these days, it seems like. Yeah.
Right. But the other thing is I'm also one of those people who has not an incredibly high interest loan, but a fairly high interest loan for my mortgage. What does that mean to me if I'm with one of these companies that may be imploding right now?
Well, now, do you mean you've got an adjustable rate mortgage and it's gone up, or you just had a fixed rate mortgage that wasn't that low to begin with?
I have an adjustable rate mortgage that has fluctuated. Interestingly, it recently went down, but mine fluctuates probably by $300 or $400 periodically throughout the year.
Right. So it hits your monthly budget when it heads up, and you have to be concerned about where that goes. Robert Schiller, what do you say to Michael? He's sitting in Cedar Rapids, watching all this unfold, looking 20, 30 years out at retirement, looking at his adjustable rate mortgage right now. How should he think? And people like him think about what they're seeing unfold here.
Well, I think it's healthy that Michael is worried. People are complacent. One evidence of that is that the personal savings rate in this country is just about zero. So people think that their 401k plan and their home appreciation is going to make them very comfortable in their retirement. But in fact, that's not the case, or may not, very well may not be the case. People are expecting to live 20 or 30 years in retirement. If you have just $100,000 saved at retirement, you've only got like $3,000 a year, and that's at risk. If it's in your home, and if you continue to borrow against it, you're in a leveraged position, and home prices may drop, and you could get a wipeout. So I think, let's not consume ourselves with worry,
right. But
it's very healthy to be worrying, and that means doing something about one's retirement planning.
Well, but Alan Sinai, I mean, it sounds as to me as though Michael is trying. He's got his 401k. I see in my note here he's 40 years old. So, I mean, he's underway. But people have this fear that, you know, once upon a time you had a guaranteed pension. And somebody else, a professional, was worrying about it. Now we're out there on our own hook. So when the tides get rough, the waves get rough like this, it's scary. People don't know what to do. We're not experienced investors, by and large.
I think the averages over the years in terms of returns on capital and returns in stock markets augur well for 401ks with a high proportion in stocks.
Over time,
and you know, we have to ride out the good times and the bad. There are many more good times than bad. A couple observations I'd make. One, by the way, is that the next move on interest rates probably will be down, not up. So those adjustable rates
could go down.
The second is that the 401k of the individual probably needs to be diversified, not just all in the U.S., because the dollar is probably on average going to keep going down.
But let's talk about outside
of the U.S. for full protection in terms of the overall return on the stock portion of that portfolio over a period of 5, 10, 15, 20
But what
years.
About interconnectedness there? We've seen, as Wall Street has wobbled, Bob Shiller, let me put this to you, global economy looking pretty good, but then Wall Street wobbles, and so do markets abroad. I mean, is there protection in being in foreign stock markets now, or if Wall Street drops, do they drop too? Bob Shiller?
Oh, well, I think that it's very wise to diversify internationally, because there's a lot of opportunity to lower one's average risk. On the other hand, stock markets and real estate markets around the world are becoming more correlated. We saw that, for example, February 27, there was an 8% drop in the Chinese stock market, mm-hmm. and then the same day, as a reaction, we had a 3.5% drop. So you don't get complete protection by diversifying internationally. But it helps, and I think that most people are not diversified outside of this country as much as they should be.
What about long-term interest rates? Alan Sinai says the Fed may well pull back at some point here pretty soon to kind of steady the boat, but with that pressure of all the borrowing we've done from overseas, can the Fed really keep interest rates low long-term? Will they be under pressure to push them up to keep the foreign money coming in to support all of our deficits and needs?
Well, long-term interest rates have been trending downward since the early 1980s, not just in the U.S. It's remarkable how this is a worldwide phenomenon. It has occurred because central banks have been very successful in controlling inflation, not just in the U.S., but all over the world.
Right.
Nothing that dramatic in a big picture sense is happening to long-term interest rates. You know, we've seen an uptick in mortgage rates and 10-year treasuries over this year.
But there's talk about China moving out of the dollar as its big reserve currency. I mean, did the chickens come home to roost at some point here? Yes, for 20 years, long-term interest rate picture has been really good. But could we be at an inflection point on that?
We saw a kind of bubble in the long-term bond market in 2003 when yields on 10-year treasuries got down to almost 3% in the U.S. And now they're just back up to some more healthy, normal levels. I don't see that there's a lot of action that I could predict based on the monetary policy outlook in the bond market right now. Maybe there's a flight to quality with the stock market variability. It could push bond prices up a little bit, but it's not a big issue at this point.
Take heart, Michael, in Cedar Rapids. Let's go to Amherst, Massachusetts, and Wayne. Hi, Wayne. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question may be a little vague to be relevant, but for someone who doesn't understand economics, I wonder what is it that scares these people, and how can we trust their judgments when they are scared, because it's so vague. The market did this. The market did that. People panic for apparently non-economic reasons, and it's a puzzle.
So when the professionals, when the wise guys on Wall Street are panicked or scared or have the jitters, let's keep our terminology sort of lined up with reality, I guess. How are we supposed to read that? Yeah, it's a good question. Alan?
I think you just hang on and watch it and see what happens. Remember, there's a lot of risk pricing going on in markets. Risks don't necessarily become reality. The fundamental concern I have is that every single business cycle upturn ends with a financial set of events which has to do with supply of credit and supply of liquidity more than interest rates. Interest rates are really relatively low.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't mean when I say that to suggest you should run out and sell all your stocks and head for the hills or even lose one night's worth of sleep. What counts most is if you have a job and you're earning a decent living and let the market gyrations go and just kind of take it easy and don't get overly exercised by it. But prudent looks at portfolios and investments from time to time are very important. Interest rates are relatively low historically.
Yep.
It is important from a longer time point of perspective to understand that the global economic geography is really changing, and it's not changing in the U.S. favor. So gradual shifts of investments for dollar-based investors,
mm-hmm.
so they participate in what's going on elsewhere in the world.
In other words, out of the dollar, into foreign markets.
Into foreign markets and foreign stock markets makes a lot of sense. And most U.S. investors, as Bob said, are not as diversified as they should be. Now, when other stock markets go down, that may be an opportunity to diversify. And there will be, I think, relative performance over time will be different between countries having to do with how they're doing economically mm-hmm. Relative to others. Asia continues to look very, very strong to us. The Eurozone does. On a relative performance basis, we just haven't been that excited about the U.S. for quite some time.
Robert Shiller, explain for us, if you could, how does it work that here we've got interest rates that, as Alan Sinai says, by historical standards, they're not so high, but yet credit is getting frozen up here. It was only a handful of weeks ago. We were, you know, looking at all these big LBOs and all the private equity action, and people were celebrating how easy credit was, and people weren't talking about the punch bowl being taken away. Does it all go back to people not, you know, being able to make their mortgage payments? Is that really what's shutting down the party here, or what's the fundamental dynamic? Is it all about the subprime mortgages?
Well, I think we can go back to John Maynard Keynes. You know that man who
yes, indeed.
Launched a whole revolution in economics in the 1930s. And what he stressed, and this is what our caller from Amherst seemed to be getting, the outlook for the economy is fundamentally unknown. We can look at the past as a suggestion, but nobody knows the future. And as Keynes put it, people don't passively react. They have sort of a intuitive judgment that drives their thinking. They have what he called animal spirits. People are reconsidering and changing their opinion. And those changes of opinion are important driving forces in our economy.
But what changed the professional's opinion on credit? It seems 5 minutes ago it was a gusher and everybody was invested in that gusher. Now it's turned off. Why?
Right. This is classic Keynesian question. It seems to me that there is a certain kind of herd behavior, a kind of social thinking that occurs during boom markets, and it creates a sense, not necessarily of complete optimism, but a sense that we're riding a wave, that this is a good time, and doubts are just deferred. We don't have time. We're doing so much business now. But when bad news comes in and when asset prices start falling, people can reconsider very fast. Once their attention is on to problems, and then when their attention shifts to problems, it feeds back and creates more problems. This is the basic problem that challenges the modern economy.
Alan Sinai, I was reading Bob Kuttner recently. He's saying we may need more regulation of some of these new financial instruments, and the reason we've got so far out on a limb, despite things being wobbly and maybe too risky, is that too many well-connected insiders are making too much easy money. Is it time for more regulation of some of the instruments that have come on stream here, or do we just have to grow into these new?
No, I think it's time for more information on the amounts of these instruments, who holds them, where they are. For example, we do not have adequate data on the non-bank financial intermediaries I talked about.
It's kind of a black box.
It's a black box. It's huge. We have lots of data on banks because they are regulated. I wouldn't want to go to regulation just to get information, but I certainly would be in favor of regulation to get information so we know what the numbers are and how big this unknown liquidity amount has been in pushing our economy up and therefore what our downside risk is on that. And we have not done our job in getting that information. And there's no reason why the institutions want to give that information because it's proprietary and they don't want to tell everybody the secrets of how they're making their money and what they're doing.
But aren't little nest eggs depend on it too, it turns out?
Well, it's the unknown that's mm-hmm. part of what's driving the markets mm-hmm. because we don't know. I'm an analyst. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It makes me more worried about what I don't know. If I knew, I might be able to size the problem and then say something reassuring about it than what I'm saying here today about the balance sheet uncertainty and the potential for it through balance sheet contraction to take our economy down. That's a scary statement, and I'm scared, and I'm being careful because mm-hmm. I don't know. It's just like any kind of illness any of us have, knowledge helps a lot.
Hard to diagnose. May be really good for us, may bring new efficiencies, but that unknown
But regulation is a little, because with regulation comes a lot of potential costs. I'm disappointed that Washington hasn't, and the economics profession hasn't pushed harder for all the benefits of the hedge funds, diversification of risk, that's kind of what we economists talk about, but we really should push them to give us more information.
When it's opaque, we don't know. David's calling from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, John. Thanks very much. Love your show.
Thank you.
I think my point is, a little earlier, one of your commentators there made a comment or kind of sized the situation up as being, well, this is all new and people are sorting it out. And I just personally don't agree with that for a second. I don't think it's new. If I look at my venture capital friends here in the Boston area, mm-hmm. they're all gambling with everybody else's money. You know, if you go ask them, well, can you put anything in this? No, of course not. We're forced not to invest in this opportunity. And these guys never get hurt. In the end, if the market crashes, you know, they don't lose their jobs, they don't lose their houses, they don't lose their health care plans. And the same's true over in the financial services business where people are playing with hedge funds. It's just the same.
Hey, but the co-president of Bear Stearns is already out on his ear. We've got imploded hedge funds over there. I mean, some of these people are losing already.
When he goes out on his ear, do you think he's worried about where his next meal's coming from payments?
No, I do not think so. But what are you saying there, David, that they know what they're doing, so we should all calm down? Or
I think they're ultra-insulated, and I think if they're going to play with big stakes and a lot of other people's money, a whole lot more of their personal situation ought to be involved in the risk, and it isn't.
Yeah, David, our time is short, but thank you for your observation. Robert Schiller, how about it? You've sounded positive on the evolution that's gone on in these financial markets. So, you know, if there's a sort of communal price to be paid, at least for a little while here now, does that change your view? Do we need to open up the box more? Does the government need to be involved or not?
I wrote a book. My book, New Financial Order, was about this topic.
Yes.
The financial innovation is a powerful engine of economic growth, but it also creates inequality. It has the potential to create income inequality. People who practice this technology have a tendency to make a lot of money. That's what I tell my students. Finance is a great field to go into if you want to make a lot of money, also if it interests you. It's important, but we have to think, and this is the big issue in our country and in other countries today. We have to think about preserving this, not just the social safety net for the poor people. We have to preserve a sense of equity, of fairness in our economy. And when people are falling between the cracks and finding that they're high and dry and they're having trouble making ends meet while somebody else is basking in millions, and he's absolutely right, the venture capital guy probably has millions even after his company goes under. That is a problem that we have to confront as a nation, and I wish we were talking more about it.
Well, I'm sure we will, but what a fascinating, and as you point out right there, not just an economic moment, but a political moment, and it's probably a moment that's not over yet. Robert Schiller, it's always great to have you. We thank you for your insights and your time. Professor of Economics at Yale University, Bob, thanks for being here today.
It's a pleasure.
And Alan Sinai with Decision Economics, Chief Global Economist, Strategist, and President there. Alan Sinai, always wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you very much.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.